The EMS Avenger podcast is sponsored by Zoll.
You'll go through withdrawal. And withdrawal is, I mean, it's in your bones. The amount of pain that you feel is into your bones. You're sweating, but you're freezing at the same time. You're so exhausted, but you can't sleep. Your legs don't stop moving. It feels like there's like spiders crawling throughout. You cannot get comfortable at all. I like to say it is the flu to the 10th power. It is the worst flu I can ever imagine. And so you're going through all of these physical withdrawals that are awful. Then you have the mental, which is just this constant circulation of, you just give it what it wants, it's going to stop, and then you get desperate.
I'm Jimmy Apple, the EMS Avenger. This is the EMS Avenger podcast, and I am here with Elizabeth Harney, who has a pretty incredible story to tell, and we're just going to walk through that story one little bit at a time. First of all, let's establish who you are now. You are a paramedic, correct? How long have you been a paramedic?
I've been a paramedic since 2017. I obtained my critical care paramedic in 2021, and then I went ahead and went through IBSC in 2023.
So that's 11 years, so it's pretty fair to say that you're here to stay, and you're even a thriver, not just a survivor, right?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
And you are in Kentucky. You've been in there the whole time, right, in Kentucky?
Yes.
Okay, and not only do you work as a paramedic, but you actually are involved in leadership in paramedicine in Kentucky. You're on several committees for the Kentucky Board of EMS, correct?
Yes, I currently serve as vice chair for our workforce committee. So we focus on recruitment and retention efforts. There have been a lot of really great projects that have come out of this committee. We established the statewide paramedic program, and we're getting ready to have 92 students graduate from this program. And then we also have EMSKY, which is been a labor of love, I like to say, where we've created a one-stop hub where, you know, if you're looking to get into EMS or you're in EMS and you need some guidance, if you're a leader, if you're an educator, whatever that looks like, we could have some sort of resource hub for you and kind of connect you to the right places.
Okay. So it's pretty fair to say that you're establishing a pretty respectable pedigree in EMS, right?
Yes. And I'm also, I'm also a proud co-founder for Paramedic Pathways. So we established this in the summer of 2025, and we provide educational scholarships to those seeking paramedic school. So I'm really excited about that. And I've had some time on our education committee for the Kentucky Board of EMS as well.
Excellent. We will put links to that in the show notes. You have been in this field for over a decade, and you have achieved even a leadership position within EMS, within your state, practicing critical care. That this happened because you made good choices the entire way through in your adult life, right?
No.
No. Okay.
No.
Let's wind the clock back about 13, 14 years or so. And you tell me what your life was at that point.
Well, prior to EMS, I spent a decade in the throes of active opioid addiction.
Okay. And how did we get there?
It started with a multitude of surgeries that began in college, and I was prescribed opioids to get through the pain, to get through surgeries and things like that. And they absolutely did what they were intended to do. I mean, they alleviated the pain. And they also kind of at times, I felt like Superwoman. I'll be honest. I felt like I could do anything and accomplish anything. And then really, before you know it, kind of that line between use and dependence really starts to blur. And then you realize that that pill is what is making me normal every day. And it doesn't take, you know, I spent a decade within opioid addiction, but you can really mask it to the outside. A lot of, you know, I had a great job at the time. I worked for the state. I worked in the education and workforce development cabinet. I had a good position there. And at the same time, I was battling this addiction, and nobody knew until the downfall.
So you weren't a party girl. You weren't showing up at parties and sharing in the party favors that people passed around at parties. You were functional. You were contributing to the betterment of society and education, had a surgery, prescribed opioids, and then there was a downward spiral from there. But even for a time, you were functionally dependent on those medications, right?
Absolutely. It controlled me brushing my teeth to start the day. It truly makes it impossible to get out of bed without needing this medication to get through.
This is a point I really want to hammer home for people right now, too, because you said something that I think is incredibly poignant, which is that you inferred that the opioids were a medication for your condition. And when people do suffer from opioid use disorder, it's important that we recognize that they are now suffering from a disease and the opioids are the medication, correct?
Absolutely. I think it's important to note that it truly is a disease because, you know, let's take my mother, for example. When my mother was prescribed the same medication, she did not have the same affinity or affliction to this medication like I did. I felt like the first time I took it, I loved it. It made me feel better. It made me feel like I could get through anything throughout my day. And it truly became something that almost felt like it made me a little bit better, which I know is crazy to say because of where it ultimately led me. But at the time, that's the way it felt. And, you know, and then you take someone like my mother who took it, she hated it. She didn't want to take it again. She didn't even think about it again. Why is that? Why is it different? Why was it different for her than it was for me?
Sure. I can remember having my gallbladder taken out about 17 years ago, and I was prescribed Vicodin. And after taking it a couple times, I was like, ugh, I hate this, you know, and I didn't want to take anymore. And that's the last time I've had opioids. But and it's also the last time I was prescribed opioids, not that I've been like highfalutin about it or anything like that. But when did you realize that there was a problem?
I realized there was a problem when, you know, right after college, I got married. I bought the house. I had a baby. I was working the job. I was doing the things. And, you know, my husband at the time also knew that I was becoming dependent on this medication. And unfortunately, this kind of became almost a leverageable piece of control that he could utilize during that time. And I knew when I would allow certain things to be said or done in conjunction with being able to receive what it is that I wanted, I knew it was a problem. I knew it was a problem because I was losing my own voice and I was losing my own, you know, I was losing my own thoughts. It was completely being almost like a puppet on a string, like do this, get this.
And that's and that tertiary
is, I was chasing
damage.
The carrot, you know?
Yeah, that's tertiary damage to addiction. It's not only what it's doing to you and doing to your body and doing to your mind, but it's a vector to allow people in to take advantage of you, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you don't, It's weird because, you know, I grew up, I was very, you know, I felt like I had a good head on my shoulders and I did very well in school and I was captain of the cheerleading team and I did all the things I was supposed to do. And to, you know, come out of graduating college and then, you know, kind of have your life all out ahead of you because you've been preparing for this. This is what you've been preparing to do. And now you're stuck in this rut of, my life is only circulating around this pill every single day. and I know I'm not the only one. I know I'm not the only one that has had this experience or that has had someone, unfortunately, use that as a vulnerable tool in order to manipulate or in order to control.
What was the process of obtaining opioids beyond the therapeutic window?
Are you talking about the effects of the drug or, you know, when they cut you off?
Yes.
And then when they cut you
right.
off, I got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
At a certain point in time, a physician is going to be like, okay, it's been X amount of days, months. Why are we still prescribing you opioids?
Yes. You can play a little bit of roulette for a little while. You can hop from physician to physician to physician to physician, and you can get by with it for a little while. But eventually, it was actually the pharmacist who alerted the most recent physician and said, hey, I think this patient is seeking because she just had all of these other different physicians that had put into the same request for this medication. So eventually, it all stopped and you're completely cut off. And now it's like, what do you do? You know,
was that
now
the
you're
first time that
off.
You were without?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And it was
so
a very
what was
scary
that process
thing.
Like? What was the process of suddenly being cut off from opioids like?
When you have been taking a substance for that long, and you're suddenly cut off and there is no titration down, there's no weaning down, nothing like that, it is, you'll go through withdrawal. And withdrawal is, I mean, it's in your bones. The amount of pain that you feel is into your bones. You're sweating, but you're freezing at the same time. You're so exhausted, but you can't sleep. Your legs don't stop moving. It feels like there's like spiders crawling throughout. You cannot get comfortable at all. I like to say it is the flu to the 10th power. It is the worst flu I can ever imagine. And so you're going through all of these physical withdrawals that are awful. And then you have the mental, which is just this constant circulation of, if you just give it what it wants, it's going to stop. And then you get desperate.
Sure. And I want to park on that point for a minute there too, because people who may not be fully educated on substance use disorder and opioid use disorder may think that it's simply just a process of you having a strong mind telling yourself to endure this pain. What people don't realize is that everything is physical. Everything that is in you and that is happening to you is a physiological process. And those opioids, their presence there influences that and their absence influences that. And so in as much as your body is now failing to work properly, your mind and your thoughts are not working properly anymore. So whoever thinks that you simply just have this mental fortitude that exists siloed away from your physical fortitude, that is just completely and abjectly wrong.
Yeah, there's a really great book that's called The Brain That Changes Itself. And I actually read it in the throes of the many times that I tried to get sober. And it talked about the brain's neuronal nets and how addiction, it can create its own neuronal net that is now sitting at the forefront of your mind. So everything that you had that you valued so dear, you know, your family and your career and good ethics and good morals and things like that, everything gets shifted back. And the only thing that's front and center is that neuronal net of addiction. And, you know, no matter how long you go in life and of however much recovery that you sustain, it doesn't go anywhere. It's still there. But the more you can put in front of it, the further kind of it goes back. But it's a really good book. I don't know if you've read it, but I think.
Well, we both were just at the Metro Atlanta EMS conference where Ginger Locke spoke mm-hmm. about some cognitive processes, and she brought up yes. Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you are without that opioid, as far as your hierarchy of needs goes, there is nothing else matters. You have to get the opioid first, correct?
Yes. Yes.
It's like
and
somebody who's hypoglycemic.
Nothing you won't do.
Yeah. It's like somebody who's hypoglycemic. They can't force themselves to function any better until they get glucose. And that is the exact same thing that happens because your body becomes dependent on the opioid. Now, you mentioned that you were actually reading up and looking for ways to become clean. So tell me about the struggle of understanding that you are addicted to an opioid and just the daily battle and what that does to you, especially when you know it's a problem and you don't want to be that. You would love to be able to just make a choice, right?
Right. I think, you know, it truly goes back to, you know, I've done a lot of research into different things of AA, NA, and to Narcanon, into smart recovery, and there's so many different programs out there that are tailored to different things. But it took years for me to even accept the fact that I had a problem. And this was after I was buying medication off the street, because you're still functioning here. You're still working. You're still keeping up with your household. You're still doing all of these pieces. And you're like, I don't have a problem. I'm still doing all of these things.
Sure.
So
at the very worst, it's a nuisance to you, right?
Right. It's
right.
there.
At least that's
right?
what you're it's telling like, yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. It went right along with, you know, putting deodorant on for the day. It was a part of that. You know, it's a part of your daily routine. And it... So first is I have a problem, and that took, I want to say that I probably was in year 7 until that happened, was that I have a problem. And so when I started to try to get help, and I kind of waved my little white flag, and I went into my first rehab center. What I noticed was that I don't think I'm as far along as these people that are here right now. I'm not there, right? So, I mean, I'm seeing people. I've met a lot of people throughout, you know, the recovery process, and you meet a lot of people in different stages of their addiction, and they've been through a lot of different things. You know, we're all there for the same reason, but it's all different levels. So when I'm there, especially in the beginning, I'm like, I'm nowhere, shape, or form there of where you are. I would never get there to that point. And your mind again starts to play tricks on you of, oh, you're good.
I'm going to interrupt you there because I think there's an interesting concept to play with there, and that, you know, we all understand the 5 stages of grief. I wonder if for some people, there's like the 5 stages of rehab where the first one is denial, even though you are in this stage of seeking help, right? Where you're like, I'm not like these other people. Is that spot on?
Absolutely. I've not thought of it that way, but absolutely. That was me for a good couple years of thinking, I must have the magical ticket where I can do this, but still have a life.
Yeah. And let me add too, that there's probably like an addiction specialist who's listening to me discover this new thing that they've known about for, you know, 18 years and have 7
but
acronyms
they call
for.
It this.
Okay. So you've gone through this process. You've been flagged by pharmacies. You have admitted to yourself now that you have a problem. You've had this first pass at rehabilitation. Where does it go wrong?
I left early, of course, because I'm like, this isn't for me. And I think I left early and I immediately went and used immediately because in my mind, I'm thinking, I can still do this. I would say within a few months of that were when things really started to spiral out of control, meaning that at that time, opioids, the pills were actually drying up. So not only from the pharmacy, but now they're drying up on the street as well, because there was a huge push at that time to, you know, get that Florida pipeline that was going on for so many years. And so during that time, it was easy to obtain those on the street. And then once that shut down, then there was nothing to buy on the street. And so the only thing that you could in place of was heroin. So I remember the day that that was offered, and they call it dog food. And I remember saying, "What's that?" And they told me, and I was like, "I can't take that." I mean, it was immediate of, "Oh, not me. I can't take that." But then I went home and I got sick. Stayed sick for a couple days to where I couldn't take it anymore. And I called him back and I said, "I'll take it." And it was and when that happened, it was a really fast downfall.
Sure. Yes. I want to touch on the fact that you left rehab and then immediately used. I think that there's a lot of people who may think, okay, well, this is just like, why did you do this? This is just mental weakness. Why did you do this? There's a YouTube channel, I think it's called Smarter Every Day. And the guy that has the channel had this thought experiment, or a physical experiment on rewiring your brain, where he rode a bicycle that you would turn it to the left in order to turn right, and you would turn it to the right in order to turn left. And the concept was completely foreign to him, because his entire life he has rode a bicycle that has an intuitive process, right? How long had you been suffering from opioid use disorder before you went to rehab?
About 7 years.
7 years. And how old were you?
I would have been in my 20s, somewhere in my
your 20s. So it's a third of your life at this point has revolved around medicating yourself with opioids. This is your normal. You don't know anything else. And suddenly, even though these opioids had lost the physical demand, there is still a mental process that simply is refusing to ride a bike the other way. What it knows is opioids and steering to the left and to the right, and getting out of rehab and not having opioids was like being asked to function by steering a bicycle the opposite way. And people really need to understand how there is two processes to that: getting clean from the opioids and then actually developing new life skills and new thought processes and new neural pathways in order to succeed. And you had done none of that. And so it was almost guaranteed that once you left, this was going to happen. Correct?
Absolutely. I think that is an important point, because by the time I left, the physical withdrawal had subsided. I was able to wake up and get through the day during that rehabilitation stay without the use of anything. But it took days to get there. But that's an important point, because when I left, I did not have that physical need to use. It was only the mental at that point. And that's where a lot of relapse happens, is we've addressed the physical. You now are no longer physically addicted to this substance, and it's all here.
But even then, I think an unforced error right there is to say that that isn't physical. Again, these are all neurons, right?
Right.
We develop a lot of neural pathways in our teenage years that, once those are developed, they are never going away unless you work incredibly hard at developing new neural pathways. And so to spend 7 years from your teens, right, into your 20s, to be expected to operate differently is just to expect human physiology to be different. And that is an expectation that cannot be met.
No, that's a very good
point. Not without
expert
guidance.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that is probably where the transition was from being functionally addicted to where you can hold a job and where you can do things and live your life. Now you've used heroin. Would you consider that to be the transition from like being functional to now you are descending into dysfunction, like
yes.
Severe dysfunction?
Yes.
Yeah.
There is no more functionality to life when you have started into a drug like heroin. It wasn't long before I lost my job. And then it wasn't long before I lost my home. It wasn't long before I lost my son. It wasn't long before I lost my car. I mean, these things just dissipate in a matter of months. So you're talking years where I'm a functional addict, I'll say. And the switch to heroin, I have now become homeless with nothing in a matter of months. It was that quick.
And what's that costing you just financially?
$50 to $100 a day, I would say.
It's another incredibly devastating toll is just the financial aspect and how you're just wrecking your life. Something that no sane person would choose to do, right? Okay, so you've lost. And to anybody who's listening and thinks maybe I'm being a little bit indelicate, I think that there's really no other way to talk about this but just to talk about it in its raw form. And I don't think that you have any hesitation about really going with me there, correct?
Oh,
yeah.
Correct.
We're not sugarcoating this. Mm-hmm. What happens to your life after you lose all of this? Where are you now?
I am couch surfing. I am sleeping in the back of cars. I am stealing. I am lying. I am doing anything and everything I need to do to feed the habit. There were so many nights of just agony and destitute. And, you know, when you're in that life, you're not necessarily surrounded by the best of the best of people. There are, you know, devastating consequences to the life that you live during this time. You know, I would like to think that some of those people did horrible things because of the drugs, or maybe they're just not good people. I don't know. But it's hard because when you're thrust into this life where nothing is off limits, and you're constantly worried about your safety. You're constantly worried about who is going to rob you. You're constantly worried about, you know, any sort of downstream effect to that. Your head is on a constant pivot. And at the same time, like, you're sick yourself. We're all sick. We're all sick and we're all desperate to feed it. That means nothing is off limits.
And not only are you desperate, but you're forced to become incredibly clever in as far as just survival goes, right? I think about this a lot. A couple of years ago, it got really cold in Georgia and it went down to about zero, which is not a very common event in the Southeast. And I happened to look out the window and it looked like somebody had spilled some trash over at some point and it was all over the lawn. And I just went out real quick to go pick it up. And I was just wearing like shorts and slippers and a t-shirt. And I was out there for maybe 5 minutes and I was so brutally cold. And I thought about that for just a second. And I was like, I am so cold and so miserable. I could not imagine being this uncomfortable for more than this amount of time. I would do anything if I was trapped in that environment. I would do anything to get out of that. Anything. I would lie. I would manipulate because, again, it's like the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I cannot get anything else done in my life. I cannot think about anything else. I cannot do anything else until this need is resolved. And so as far as the hierarchy of needs goes, when you're living that life and you are in a community that are all, I almost said sharing that lifestyle. It's not a lifestyle. When you are all subjected to this affliction, you are forced to become incredibly clever and you become desperate in the expectation that you are going to make rational decisions that protect yourself and other people is unrealistic, right?
Yes. I remember some of the hardest times in my life was in the winter. And, you know, to be in the throes of a heroin addiction, to have no place really that you can lay your head down at night, and it be freezing outside at the same time. I remember I didn't have proper clothes. I didn't have socks. The first thing I begged for when I finally got one of the last days I woke up and I was desperate to get out of that. I was freezing. I had just been robbed again. I had nothing. And I just can't explain how much I hated myself. And I still had my car at this point, which most of the time I would try to sleep in there, but I didn't have enough gas or would even put the money towards the gas to make it for it to run so you could have heat. That didn't exist. But I had, the light was on and I went on fumes to this rehab that I knew was there. And I remember walking in, I had no socks. I was so cold. I never knew you could be that cold. And I begged them, please take me in here. Please. I got to get out of here. I can't, I know people that have never experienced that. But that was hard.
And it's actually pretty amazing how that desperation, once you've reached the end of the path of desperation, that it actually will drive you towards the one rational decision that you can make, right? So what was that experience like at that point?
I just
did you feel different about the other people this time?
No, now I felt like I'm right there with them. Our stories are similar now, right?
Okay, yeah. Now we're in the acceptance phase.
Yeah. I came with nothing. I didn't have any clothes. I had absolutely nothing that I went in there with. But just begging for them to give me a bed. And they did, and I was so grateful for that. And you know, within these rehabilitation facilities, it's not just the detox position. It is, you know, you're given classes and you have group therapy and you have individual therapy and things like that. And from the rehab set up before this point, I was half listening in any of those times. You know, if you really don't feel like you're supposed to be there, then you're really not going to pay attention into those sessions, or you maybe not feel like it's applicable to you. But I remember that time I was locked in. I'm like, whatever you have to tell me to do, I'm going to do it, because I can't go back out there again. I can't go back out there and live this way and be around these. I just can't do it anymore. And what's so crazy about that is I went from this facility and they transferred me to another one, like a longer term, and I was doing well. I was, you know, very active in the classes. I was, you know, forming positive relationships with not only the counselors and the providers there, but also the other people that were there as well that were fighting just as hard as I was. And I had put probably more time than I'd ever had, around, you know, 25 days or so, which I know doesn't sound like a lot, but at that time it was a lot for me. And I remember I woke up one morning and I'm like, I'm going to leave. I'm done. And I left. I left it all. I went walking down the road and found a ride and ended up right back where I was. And that's crazy to me because, you know, it took a morning of me waking up in desperation of, please, I've got to get out of this. And then I put a little bit of time under, and then it just takes one more morning where you wake up and you're like, no, I'm going to leave.
What do you think is the trigger there? You're actually, now you're actually working the program, right? So what's the trigger?
I don't feel like there was a trigger. And that's the manipulation of addiction, is that it can play in your mind so
You know what?
Hard.
I just realized I walked into a trap there, a thinking trap, which was there is no trigger. You suffering from a disease. It is the disease, and the disease will tend to win out if you're not protecting yourself from it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you're not really ready with all the tools and the things that you need to notice the trigger and then be able to kind of go into the tools in your tool belt and pull something out to combat the trigger. If you're not quite there yet, then the manipulation of addiction is still there. Like that neuronal net is still front and center, regardless of however many days you've just put together.
Addiction is such an exposure of fallacies, probably one of the most incredible exposure of fallacies out of any concept that's out there. You know, that was a fallacy there that like after 20 something days you beat addiction and then just something went wrong, like you tripped over a rock, when in reality you are suffering from addiction. You will always suffer from addiction unless you work the program. And then even then, in spite of that, sometimes something's going to happen. I'm also looking back at the diplomas that are on your wall, and I'm thinking back to when I qualified your on-ramp into substance use disorder by the fact that you were not a party girl, partaking of party favors. And I do want to make sure that it's clear to people who are listening that it does not matter what your on-ramp into addiction was.
No.
And I'm not trying to establish a hierarchy within addiction. You know, that is a lie. And once you are suffering from substance use disorder, you are suffering from substance use disorder. And the disease wins. It doesn't matter how you got there. Okay, so you've left. I don't think that we need to have a huge setup to what your life was like after that, because there's no real way for it to get any better from there. So we're continuing to deteriorate at this point, right?
Oh, yeah.
So
within a couple days of that, I found myself in jail.
Was that the first time?
And that was the first time.
Okay.
And I was terrified. And I was in a lot of pain because of the events that led up to me going to jail. But you really recognize the level of communication that you receive from, you know, people within, you know, police or people within corrections. And I remember being so shocked at times of, you know, why are you talking to me this way? You know, without any provocation, I don't understand the disdain towards me. I have not done anything to you. I have not said anything out of order. I have not, you know, anything of that nature. And, you know, you're treated like a piece of trash. And I will call it like it is, because that is how I was treated. That is how I was spoken to. And that is how I was handled. It was 14 days of pure hell.
And what was the process that got you out?
At the time, my mother didn't know where I was. And I had put that woman through more. I can't even imagine all the years that she spent worrying about me. And, you know, for her to think that I'm in a rehab center and now they can't find me and I'm gone. So I was missing for a long time. And I finally got the nerve to call her. And she's like, oh, thank God. And I'm like, thank God I'm in jail. She's like, yes, because I know you're safe. I know where you are. And I was begging her to come get me out. Here's this my bail. Please let me out. It's freezing in here. And it was just so chaotic. Mm-hmm. And she's like, No, I know where you are and you're safe. And she was actually working with my public defender, who was actually a really, really nice lady. I was very appreciative of her. She and her worked out a place for me to go, and they felt it was best if I went out of state somewhere so I could not leave.
Sure.
Because I had nowhere to go or nowhere familiar, at least. So they actually worked out a place in Michigan that I was to see the judge, and then I actually flew out the next day.
Okay. And where did that lead you? That was a rehabilitation program, correct?
Okay. Yes.
Did you get all the way through it?
I did. It was the only time I've ever graduated a program. it was a very different program, but I was very appreciative of that because it brought a lot of different concepts that were actually resonating with me during the time. So they were actually what's called a Narconon program, which I know actually pulls from a lot of Scientology-based aspects of things, which I know scare people. But, you know, they say it's brainwashing.
Eat the meat, throw away the bones, right?
But honestly, it's like I needed a little brainwashing at the time. Mm-hmm. I needed a cleanse to be able to get through it. So it was a very good program for me. And there were people from all over the country that were there. And you just made such huge connections with all of these people that have went through all of these different walks of life. And you're in classes all day long. I mean, it does not stop. And there were a lot of sessions where I'll talk about one. It was called bull baiting. And so we did a lot of work where, you know, you would sit 3 feet away from somebody that's directly face to face with you. You're making eye contact. And you had to build up to this point. But when you got to bull baiting, the other person would start kind of trying to bait you a little bit. You know, you are a junkie. You are a terrible mother. You have done this. You have done that. And the point was for you not to react to that language, right? Because for so long, we had been to a point where you were reacting to the things that people were saying. I was reacting when people would say or do things to me for that entirety of addiction. And it was amazing because you would have to sit there for 2 hours with somebody just berating you for 2 straight hours and you could not react. You couldn't shut your eyes. You couldn't look away, anything like that. You were conditioning yourself to not have that reaction there. So there were a lot of different sessions throughout, even going all the way down into theory and things like that, where I really actually started to pick up so many different tools and ways to regulate myself, and ways to, you know, notice when triggers are starting to happen and what my response would be. This was a program that was not short. I was there for months. And I remember, she might get mad at me for saying this, but I remember when I was getting close to graduation. And I was so proud of myself at this time. And I remember calling my mom and saying, "Mom, are you going to come out for my graduation?" And she's like, "Oh, yeah, that's something to be proud of, you know." And I'm like,
"Yikes.
I am actually really proud of this because I got through it. And I've learned so much. I've learned so much about the human condition. I've learned so much about me. I've learned so much about this disease. And, you know, now I kind of feel ready. Step back out into the world again and to try this again." That was a proud moment for me.
And so you left that program and then you never used another opioid again.
Not true.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. No.
Okay.
I wish that was the case because that's, you know, for optics and things like that, of course, that sounds great.
And that wasn't meant to diminish the accomplishment there. The insidiousness of addiction is that you can have an experience like that and be right back where you started.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
it's sad, but it's true. Yeah.
I don't want this to become kind of like torture porn now where we kind of like are exploiting every up and down. So let's skip a couple of beats here. First of all, you've interacted with EMS as someone suffering from addiction, correct?
Yes.
Have you overdosed?
Yes.
Okay. And what was that experience like the first time to be using and then suddenly looking at EMS looking at you?
Well, the time that I overdosed, I was in a pretty rundown motel, and I had I was missing for all terms concerning with my family, and I had actually laid in a very contorted position. I had passed out in a very contorted position, and I laid there for about 24 hours until housekeeping found me the next day, and they had called 911. And I remember when I woke up, it felt like, one, I was underwater. Everything sounded like everybody was talking, but I was underwater. So it was really hard for me to understand what was going on. The other part was I couldn't move. I had actually, what I know now of being rhabdomyolysis,
right,
but
right.
At the time I didn't know why my legs weren't working. That I couldn't move. And I just remember looking up and this man is just screaming at me to walk over to the stretcher. I'm saying, I can't. And he was getting so frustrated with me not being able to walk over to the stretcher. And I just kept telling him, I can't. And finally, they got me up and put me on there. Not gentle, I would say. And I remember I am just confused. I am so confused. I don't know what day it is. I don't know what's happened. All I know is everybody sounds like I'm in water. And it's just all coming at once. They're mad at me and I can't walk. So it was a lot of emotions going on at once. And I remember when they actually put me in the back of the ambulance, I am very confused. And I had a paramedic who she sat right beside me on the bench, and she needed to start my IV and things like that. And she was so truly endearing. And, she looked me in my eyes and she truly treated me as if my life still had some sort of value. Just, you are better than this. You don't have to live this way. And it's like, not that I haven't heard that in the past from other, whether it was in a rehab or maybe even my own family, it wasn't necessarily maybe the words, but it was the timing. It was the timing of, oh my God, I just had a year sober. I just lost it all. And for what? I almost lost my life. I can't walk. And for me, that was my true utter moment of defeat. And in that moment was when those words actually connected with me somehow. I don't know if you just have to be in that dire or a desperation, but when you are, words like that matter.
The right person has to be there to deliver those words, right? You can say the words, you don't have to live this way, right? Mm-hmm. Or you can say the words, you don't have to live this way, right? You can just choose not to do this, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
They have to be delivered with someone who actually believes you're capable of more, who believes that you didn't choose to be there in the first place, and who actually is invested in your outcome. Right.
Right.
And what I want for people who are in EMS and in the healthcare system to take away from that is just that every single contact that you have with someone who, whether or not they made choices that led to where they are currently, they're not going to get where you think they should be by you exerting your will against them. It reminds me of a story where the sun and the wind are in a competition. They see a gentleman who has an overcoat on, and they decide to compete to see who can get the person to take that overcoat off. And so the wind gears up and blows as hard as he can, and the gentleman just kind of pulls his coat tighter. And so the wind's like, I'm gonna do this again. And so he rears back a little bit more, and just sheer winds blowing at this guy, and the guy pulls his collar up. And then he's like, okay, this time I'm going to give everything I got, and just gives hurricane force winds against this guy. And he just pulls his coat in, puts his hat on, and resists it with everything that he has. And the sun's like, my turn. And the sun just smiles and beams. And the guy takes his coat off. You simply cannot will a person into change.
Right.
And so you have to plant that seed that may not sprout tomorrow. It may not sprout the next day, but those roots are growing, right?
Yes. And, you know, and like I said before, it cost her nothing. It cost her nothing to be kind. It didn't cost her any time. It didn't cost her any extra knowledge that she had to research. It didn't cost her any additional skill that she had to practice. It was just kindness. In a timing where I needed it the most. And that's what's so important for anyone. I don't, EMS, PD, corrections, fire, working in a grocery store, whatever it is, just having kindness. It costs you nothing to do.
But it gives you something back too. When you tap into kindness, data shows that when you perform 5 acts of kindness in a week, that it actually changes you for the positive. It creates new neural pathways that lead to better outlooks, and it improves your level of happiness. And you can choose to tap into that, and your life will get better. And the more that you do that, the better your life will become. Or you can choose to tap into toxicity, and you just end up being a part of this human centipede, pardon me being crude, this human centipede of toxicity that you can't break out of. And so when you find someone who is suffering, and you can find a place within you to be kind to that person, you are not just saving that person, you're saving yourself.
Yes, yes, yeah, yes. I think that's why I've been so adamant about, you know, when I stepped into education, and now I actually have an ability to start shaping culture before they actually hit into our services. This was important where I wanted them to feel that. And that's why it's important of, you know, doing a little bit of community service. You know, you feel good when you do it. You know, you may, you know, sigh and moan and gripe and things like that because you're already busy with clinicals and ride time and classes and things like that. But when you get through it, oh my God, how good do you feel? And that plays right into that. You're feeding your own happiness piggy bank at the same time while you're doing good for others.
You talked about culture. Something I think is a concept we really need to acknowledge is that we've reached a point in addiction and substance use disorder where we actually have to change our culture to continue to help people. 75% of people suffering from substance use disorder will recover. And we can hasten that recovery, or we can inhibit that recovery. And we've made such strides in getting people towards recovery. And at this point, we're at the point of diminishing returns because we are culturally resistant to what needs to be in place to get more people to recovery, which is understanding and support. Mm-hmm. And so we are at a point now where we have to change the culture in healthcare and society as a whole to be able to be in a support and understanding position in order to keep moving that number towards 100 and even to steer people away from it in the first place.
Yeah. And I think it's important to note too, of working in EMS, you know, we never get to see the outcomes of this. We never do. You know, you only ever see the overdose, or you only ever see the downfall, or you only ever see somebody's worst moment. And a lot of times you never get to see the outcome of that. So I can understand why people feel like it's futile to continue to try to, you know, even if it's just being kind, or even if it's maybe offering them a phone number that they could utilize to see if they could find a bed somewhere or some sort of bridge in order to get them some better help. I can understand how that would feel like, is this really helping? Is this really doing anything? And the reality of it is, yes. Yes, it is helping. Maybe you gave that phone number and they put that in their pocket and maybe they called it in a month and it saved their life. You never know. And that's the quiet truth of this work, right? A lot of times we influence people we never see again, but we still have to do it.
Yeah. All right. Take me to the turning point now, where we have gotten to the place where wherever the point of a recovery is, that has gotten you to where you are now.
So after I spent about a week in the hospital. Post that overdose, I was pretty sick. Tick levels were through the roof. I had a lot of recovery to do. And so at the same time, I'm actually able to medically detox because I'm in the hospital as well. I remember my mom coming to the hospital, and she had stated that I could stay with her. And I was so grateful for that, just to be able to have a place to go. And I went there and I just focused on structure of, you know, I'm going to set my alarm. I'm going to make my bed. I'm going to go to meetings. I'm going to connect with a sponsor. I'm going to do all of these things that I need to do and say structure. And it was probably three or four months of just doing that. It's very, you know, kind of like I said in that presentation, like there's no transformation there. You know, it's just, you're just doing little things every day to try to kind of clean up your life, or just try to create structure enough to get through your day. And you're just really focusing on the day. Like, I'm not going to use today. I'm not going to use this hour. I'm not worrying about tomorrow. I'm worrying about right now, and this is what I'm going to do.
Just doing the next right thing.
Yeah. I just kept it very minimal and very, very just focused on today. And within a few months of that, went to church, and I kind of turned around and I saw someone sitting a few rows back, and she was wearing a jacket and it said paramedic. When they say that, you know, things come in signs, you know, you're like, okay, no, that truly was a sign for me, because I never stopped thinking about her. All these months, I never stopped thinking about her true kindness and what she did for me that day. And just the fact that she even looked at me like I had value there. She didn't have to say anything. You could just tell. And, you know, I started researching it, and I found a school that it looked like it was a decent price. And I kind of talked to my mom about it, and she's like, I don't know. Are you going to be able to get through this? And I'm like, I want to try this. And I remember I started my first day, and I'm like, This is awesome. You know, I had been working in, you know, business for a majority of my life. That's my undergrad. It is business management and marketing. And now I'm into healthcare, and I'm seeing all of these interventions that we do every single day for so many people that are strangers. And it was so powerful to me. And so now I'm like, I'm really focusing on my sobriety. I'm still going to meetings. I'm still, you know, connecting with my sponsor. I'm still following structure, but now I'm also kind of pouring myself into this new profession, this new, I almost want to say shiny thing that I'm able to really put some focus into. And I remember I was kind of nervous that I wasn't sure how many brain cells I had left at that time. Am I going to really be able to do this? Have I just destroyed them all? And when I got my first test grade back and it was good, I'm like, I think I can do this. Like, I think I'm going to be able to get through this. And
I just want to, I want to echo this a little bit because there's so many parallels. So I've shared with you that I suffered from addiction a long time ago, and I almost lost my life from an incident related to that use. And I was I received nothing but castigation while I was in the hospital until one nurse who was Irish, and so she had this Irish lilt, if that's the correct way to say it, just was nice and kind. And I will remember that for the rest of my life. I will remember her for the rest of my life because it made all the difference. It just gave me the will to do better. And I did do better after that. I walked away from that and left that life behind. Fast forward to getting into paramedic school when I got my, or EMT school, and I got my first grade and realized, I'm smart. I can do this. It's an incredible feeling, right?
It really is. It's almost a, I can do this. I can do something else. I can do something new. I can get better. And so all of these things are happening at the same time, you know, getting, because I was only 4 months sober when I started EMT school. Which is, for me to say that now, it's like, wow, I was only 4 months sober when I started that. But it truly, I mean, it
got to strike while the iron's hot, right?
Yeah. It was amazing. And I'm proud that I took the step thinking that, you know, could this be me one day? Could I do this? And the answer was yes. Anybody can do anything. That you put truly anybody can do anything if you put what you want to have into it. Anybody.
How many years have you been sober?
I've been sober over 10 years.
That is absolutely amazing.
Yes. Yes.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
Having known you for, you know, only a little over a year or so, just I'm inspired by you and I'm proud of you. And I'm incredibly grateful to actually, you know, get to interact with you and get to see you at conferences and things like that. We are getting towards the end of our hour. And so I want to give you a moment to get any message out that you want to get out about this.
You know, one line that I keep going back to because I think it is so powerful is that your presence is an intervention. It truly is. And I am living proof of that. And I will not stop sharing my story, no matter how hard it gets some days, no matter how many times that I just kind of want to curl up into a ball and kind of hide out and not talk about this as much as I am, because it is hard. It's the fact that people need to understand that their presence is an intervention. And if I have to stand on the rooftops and share my story to do that, then so be it. If other, you know, EMS professionals want to utilize my story for the next patient that they have, do it. Whatever it takes to help someone else. But, you know, take the time to understand and be kind.
And you've recovered so much in your life since then. I mean, you've became a paramedic. We've talked about where you've gotten in your professional career, but also you are a wife, you are a mother, you are a homeowner, and everything that you've lost, you've been given back tenfold.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I never want to seem like I am gloating or anything. I feel, you know, whether, you know, I post something on social media or what have you, and it's truly because I'm proud of all the things that I have gotten back. That of all the times that I thought, you know, all hope was lost and how other people thought I was a lost cause, being able to obtain and be successful in not only my career, but in my life is I'm so proud of that, because I want other people to see it's I'm not a unicorn with this. There's so many other people that recover as well. You have to, like, people have to know that it is possible. And that's why I like to share my story and those things. But I'm very grateful for the people
possible.
That gave me a shot.
It's possible, but not necessarily because of the choices they make. I really want people to walk away from this understanding that quite often it's not the choices that they make. It's the choices that you make that actually can influence them to recover, not only to recover physically, but to recover what they've lost.
Yes, absolutely. I there's no limits to, you know, to what you can do. There's no limits to what I can do, and there's no limits to what anybody else can do. And to think that there are, it is of disservice. So that's all it takes is believing in you, believing that you can do it, no matter what anybody else says, no matter what anybody else thinks, believing in that part of you, and just keep going. I don't plan on stopping anytime soon.
This has been the EMS Avenger podcast. I have been joined by Liz Harney telling us her amazing story. Remember, everyone, saving lives begins with kindness.
Dark clouds rising black and gray, screams of chaos wave.